Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, President Obama urged the FCC to protect net neutrality and prevent broadband companies from dictating what websites we can visit or which streaming services we can use. But what's not getting much attention is this. According to the Boston Globe, President Obama made one exception to the public utility regulations for the internet, and that is the government should not dictate the prices consumers pay for service. In recent years, several surveys have shown high costs for low speeds compared to the rest of the world. According to a new report by the New America Foundation called The Cost of Connectivity, residents of Seoul, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Bucharest, and Paris enjoy much faster internet download and upload speeds for less than $40 a month. In American cities like Chattanooga and Kansas City, where internet speeds are comparable to Seoul and Hong Kong, it costs about twice as much. So why is the United States lagging behind when it comes to internet speeds and affordability? And how does cost and connectivity figure into the net neutrality debate? Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David K. Johnston explored these issues in his book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And he found that Americans pay four times as much as the French for an internet triple play package, that's phone, cable TV, and internet, at an average of $160 per month versus $38 per month in France. And the French get global free calling and worldwide live television. Their internet is also 10 times faster at downloading information and 20 times faster uploading it. Also, Americans pay 38 times as much as the Japanese for internet data. So how did this happen? David K. Johnston won a Pulitzer while at the New York Times. He teaches business, tax, and property law of the ancient world at the Syracuse University College of Law and writes a column for Al Jazeera America. David is the best-selling author of Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and editor of the new anthology Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, glad to be here, Rose.
Great to have you. We are also joined by Christopher Mitchell. Christopher is policy director at Next Century Cities, a recently launched consortium of 32 cities dedicated to ensuring the availability of broadband internet for all communities. He also directs the Community Broadband Networks Initiative with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance in Minneapolis and MuniNetworks.org. That's an online clearinghouse of information about community broadband. And Christopher joins us from Amsterdam. Hi, Christopher. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So, David, I want to start off with you because President Obama's comments on net neutrality have been getting so much attention. But as I mentioned in the intro, what's not getting attention is the fact that he made one exception to the public utility regulations for the internet, and that is that the government should not dictate the prices we pay for service.
Well, this goes to the core of whether we're going to treat the internet as a utility, the way we do or historically did the telephone system, or we're going to exempt it. And what the industry worries most about is price regulation. Some years ago, they got Congress to pass a law that prevented local municipalities from setting the prices. That's what had been happening. And in many cases, there were negotiations in towns that cared about these things. But it is part of an effort to compromise with this industry where basically you don't have the discipline of the market. Funny or Die, which puts videos up on the internet and is run by a bunch of people in Hollywood, has a very funny one about Comcast. It's rather crude, but it basically is, you know, we've heard all your complaints. We know that you think we have the worst customer service in America and that we cost way too much and that our internet is slow and we don't care. You don't like us? Who else are you going to get service from?
Yeah, exactly.
You want to get it from Hulu? We own Hulu.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up because when you think about what we, you know, just the sort of the landscape in 1996, the U.S. was the top broadband country in the world. Back then, we had 15 national ISPs and a dozen big telephone companies. Today, we have just 5 ISPs and 3 phone companies. And I hear this all the time from friends who say, I want to cancel Comcast, but there aren't any other alternatives. So how did we get to a point where we have so few ISPs and so few telephone companies?
Well, we set up rules that make it very difficult for anyone else to enter the field, even though technically we remove the barriers to competition. Now, there is some good news here. For example, here in Western New York, I'm coming to you from Syracuse University's radio station today, and I live in Rochester, about 80 miles away. There are some entrepreneurs who are stringing fiber optic cable and are competing with Time Warner, soon to become Time Warner Comcast, to provide internet service. And there are other places around the country where entrepreneurs are doing this, but they're a tiny segment of the market. They are, however, the first early shoots of spring in the economy on this that suggests that we may get actual competition and we may get some price effect.
So since you brought up copper, in some parts of the country, the information is transmitted over copper and not fiber. So can you talk about the differences there and how do we find out how our information is being transmitted? Because that's really important, right?
Sure. Well, in fact, within the signal of KALW toward the north, there are places in around Petaluma, Sonoma County and above that only have copper wire available. And copper wire can handle about 4,000 calls on a circuit. A glass fiber thinner than a human hair in the most sophisticated form can handle probably 1 million calls. It's tremendous capacity when you go to a fiber optic system. And so large cities, places that have large business customers tend to have fiber optic. Rural areas tend not to at all. New Jersey was supposed to be 100% wired for the areas served by Verizon under a law that was passed and that allowed the company to raise rates to finance it. They are trying to walk away from that under a rule that would let them wire, I think it's 20 buildings in each census tract where about 1,500 people live, and then they wouldn't even be required to provide service. They just have to run a line past the first 20 houses or businesses. So it's very important that we develop a network like they're doing in other parts of the country. You can go to rural Korea. You can go to rural Hungary or Slovakia, both of all three of which I've been to, and get fiber optic service that's very cheap and very, very fast.
And Christopher, you are in Amsterdam, and in this New America report looking at internet here versus the rest of the world, Amsterdam is also noted for its fast internet. What are your speeds like in Amsterdam compared to where you live in the U.S.?
Well, I'm actually just visiting, and so I was just having a conversation tonight with someone who lives in Amsterdam about this. You know, my hotel here in Amsterdam is not that different from other hotels. The Wi-Fi is a little bit more usable. But when I walk down the street, I see advertisements for a triple play package from the cable company, which is competing with fiber from the telephone company. And the triple play of telephone, television, and internet service that they offer here is half the cost of mine in St. Paul, Minnesota, and about twice as fast for the internet connection. So it's about a four-time impact, I guess I would say, which is fitting with what David was reporting on earlier. It's remarkable, the difference, frankly. And Amsterdam isn't considered to be one of the more amazing cities. In Stockholm, it's far superior than what you can get here. And it's so much better than you can experience almost anywhere in San Francisco or New York City or other major cities.
In the U.S., an average cost of the triple play is about $160. So what is it in Amsterdam?
Actually, here it's there's a promotional deal, and then it gets up to as high as 56 euro, which will probably be what, $65-$70, I would say.
Right.
So it's for much faster speeds typically. Although I think there's probably fewer television channels, so we can't rule that out.
Well, nothing lost there, right? Depending on what they feature. So how do you explain the price discrepancies?
Well, I think that there's a major role in the lack of competition. The big cable and telephone companies in the United States have dominated. They haven't had to face competition, and they know that they're unlikely to face competition because if the three of us wanted to build a network in any major city, we would have to raise a ton of capital, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And the first thing that would happen is that the cable company and the telephone company there would lower their rates dramatically. So the same people that are fed up with that service would have to choose whether or not they wanted to pay less for that service that they hated or more for our new service. And what we know across the United States is that Americans tend to want to pay the least amount. They are very price sensitive. And whenever a company has tried to come in and compete with a cable company, even a hated cable company, they find that a significant number of people will stay with that hated cable company rather than going to a competitor, even if the price is a little bit higher. And even more remarkably, this is all understanding that the price drops for everyone in the whole market. And so if we form this cable company that we're talking about and we build it, the price people would pay us is less than they're paying the monopolist. And they probably know that if they keep paying the monopolist that lower price in the market, that they are going to regain the market and the prices are going to go up for everyone. So even though we know this intellectually, that prices, that we should pay a little bit more to preserve competition, we don't do that. And that's something we see in market after market, and it results in a duopoly that is very harmful for the rest of our economy.
David, what would you add to that? In your book, The Fine Print, you, and in many interviews you've done, you have said that the telecom industry got the rules changed while we weren't watching.
Yes, there was some coverage of it, but you had to be a serious consumer of news, and then you had to read through the jargon. Christopher's exactly right about what happens here. We had market entry in Sacramento, and immediately AT&T cut its prices to put the folks who were trying to do this out of business. In Scottsboro, Alabama, they created a municipal system, and the prevailing investor-owned cable company, I think it was Scripps, immediately undercut their prices. Now, in that case, the town succeeded in saving its system because it went to every single customer and wrote them letters. And it's a small town. I think there were 1,200 customers, and said, if you don't stay with us, then prices will go back up because we will go out of business. And people figured that was probably true, and so their system has done very well. But there's an additional problem beyond the way the rules have been set up to encourage price gouging, and that is redundancy. When we had the Ma Bell telephone monopoly, for all of its high costs and other problems, it was 99.999999% reliable. Here in Western New York, Time Warner's voice over internet protocol telephone, the first time it went out for 6 hours from Albany to Buffalo, it made the news. Big stories. When it happened a year later, it got like one paragraph in some newspapers. It now happens all the time for varying lengths of time where you just try to make a call and the calls don't go through. It's not news anymore. We need to have, for businesses to be able to operate reliably, especially businesses and law enforcement and first responders, we need to have reliable systems that have redundant backups. We shouldn't have any or virtually any failures in the system.
David K. Johnston won a Pulitzer while at the New York Times. He teaches business tax and property law of the ancient world at the Syracuse University College of Law and writes a column for Al Jazeera America. In David's book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, he found that Americans pay four times as much as the French, for example, for an internet triple play package that's phone, cable, and internet at an average of $160 a month here versus $38 a month in France. Also, Americans pay 38 times as much as the Japanese for internet data. And so if you'd like to weigh in on this conversation and talk about your experience, how much are you paying for the internet? How have things changed over the past couple of decades? What do you think of your service? If you use an alternative to one of the big ones, we'd love to hear from you. We talk about alternatives whenever we discuss issues like this. What is the service like between, say, Comcast, AT&T, and a small provider? And then has your city been pushing for local control of your internet services? We'll also talk about that later in the show. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment online, yourcallradio.org. David, if we step back and look at the Telecommunications Act, which was signed by President Bill Clinton in 1996, lobbyists and politicians at the time promised that the act would foster competition. But many people, including Jonathan Turley, a lawyer, says instead what happened is it allowed them to divide the markets and merge into effective monopolies, imposing higher charges and lower quality services. So Can we point to the Telecom Act and say that's one of the big reasons why we're paying such high prices for inferior services?
Oh, absolutely. The 1996 Telecom Act was a terrible, terrible law for consumers. And there were people who wrote about it. I mean, the New York Times carried pretty good stories about it, for example, at the time. But this is complicated stuff. It's hard for people to understand. In an ideal world, we would have robust competition in telecom. In a less than ideal world, we would have heavily regulated monopolies that provide us with first-rate service. What we have instead is the worst of all possible worlds, which is no competition and no regulation. And so, you know, if your system goes out, well, you know, we'll get a cable guy out to you someday. I mean, we have movies made about this stuff.
Right.
So we need to have sensible regulation. It was very interesting, by the way, Rosa, to see what happened to the headlines when President Obama made his announcement in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. They both played it as page one with one column heads. The New York Times headline was something along the lines of President Obama promotes net neutrality. The Wall Street Journal headline was Obama promises heavy regulation of Internet.
When in fact, what will be regulated?
Well, the idea that the president's put forward is to make sure that the Internet is available to everybody who gets onto it at the same speed and the same price. What the cable companies want to do is set up a system where people will pay them to get into a fast lane, and if you don't pay them for it, whether you're a consumer or a provider, you'll be relegated to a slow lane. What's really troubling about this is that Comcast, which owns NBC, Universal Studios, and a whole bunch of other things, is both the carrier and the provider. So it can favor its content over CBS or BBC or Al Jazeera America, and that should trouble us a great deal. That's completely undoes the notions of the benefits of competition and open markets.
And last year, Comcast took in $64 billion, generating $13 billion in operating income, $7 billion in net profits. And now Comcast wants to merge with Time Warner, the second biggest cable company in the country.
I think they want to take it over.
Yeah, I think that's just a terrible, terrible idea. This increased consolidation is incredibly threatening. One of the things that I just wanted to throw in with regard to the 96 Telecom Act is that, you know, if you look at the broad goals of it and the people who wrote it, they'll say it was to encourage competition. The idea being that because of the wired monopoly that we talked about, the dynamic earlier that we talked about, it's not feasible to have many different wire providers. And so if you have a wired provider, that wire can support, and as David said earlier, so many different phone calls, it can support many different Internet providers all offering service over it. So we have one electrical hookup to our house. We have one sewer and water hookup to our house. We don't have companies competing to provide multiple of those hookups. The goal here would be that you have one really fast fiber network on the side of your house, and you could choose services from many different providers. I think that's our ideal world of competition. It's what the 96 Act was aiming at, but totally missed for a variety of reasons. And it's something that we see cities now trying to reestablish, although it's still a very challenging path. And so just a question that I would throw out there as well for people to call in and talk about would be this. If your city said to you, we're going to assess your property for an extra $15 or $20 per month, so that you can have a fiber put on the side of it, and you're going to have a choice of many different providers, and we think your telecom bill is going to go down by at least $20, possibly even $50. If we do this, would you be interested in that?
Well, would you? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on why Internet speeds are much lower in the U.S. compared to the rest of the world, yet we pay much more for the service, especially when you're talking about one of these triple pay packages, for example? And if you've traveled overseas, what was your experience like in comparing the speeds overseas and the speeds you get here at home? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And then going back to the fiber optic infrastructure, which is a priority in other countries, and it's been largely a abandoned by most companies here to avoid the costs. Yeah. David, you've pointed out that over the course of the last 20 years, nearly $500 billion has been collected by the telecom companies to allegedly bring the U.S. into the 21st century with an information highway. But what was promised has not been delivered when it comes to fiber optic lines. What will it take to get companies to actually build these lines? Do you think it's even possible at this point?
Oh, I think it's entirely possible to do so. And I think it's, for the growth of the economy, essential that we do so. It's going to take a lot more money. I mean, I do think the one argument the phone companies have made is that, big as that number sounds, and it is a huge number, $500 billion, that it wasn't enough money. They didn't understand fully the real costs of wiring large cities and various areas. And we didn't have sort of a national plan of how to do this in a thoughtful way. One of the things telephone and cable companies want to do right now is just stop serving, except perhaps by Wi-Fi, very distant areas. Universal service has been fundamental to the economic growth of America. It, I believe, has produced enormous economic benefits, and cutting off areas that are rural or hard to reach because it's in the interests of the companies as unregulated, non-competitors, I think is exactly the wrong way to go. But that is clearly one of the things that the telecom companies want. They want to serve only the profit, what they regard as the profitable customers, which basically means the less dense your population area, the less interested they are in running any wire where you are. And they want to replace this with service over the air. There are a couple of barrier islands in New Jersey that no longer have wireline service or internet service. They only have service via something that's similar to Wi-Fi. Merchants cannot use that system to charge customers with credit cards, unfortunately.
Well, let's take a caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Donald in Berkeley. Hi, Donald.
Yes, hi, Rose, and hi, David. It's Don Goldmacher. The point that I wanted to make here is that the cable companies have systematically made it impossible for local communities to have freestanding, publicly owned internet. And in fact, here in California, they lobbied vigorously the Democratic-controlled legislature about 10 or 15 years ago to make it impossible for additional cities to do their own internet high-speed setup, and those that already existed were allowed to stay, but now it's next to impossible to do it locally, and that seems to me the next stage of not only resisting what the FCC might or might not do, but to begin to take back what I consider publicly owned airwaves, since our tax dollars paid for the development of the internet to begin with, and again, we gave this away.
Well, thank you for that. After the break, we will talk about those local laws and efforts to give citizens more control, and cities, really, more control over this. So thank you for calling in, David. Today we are talking about, I'm sorry, Donald. Today we're talking about why we pay so much for inferior service here in the U.S. compared to the rest of the world. We pay up to 38 times as much as Japanese citizens pay to access the internet, and we rank 31st in download speeds behind Hungary, Estonia, and Slovakia. So how did this happen? In 1996, the U.S. was the top broadband country in the world. Why are we paying so much? What is your connection like? How much do you pay? And if you've been overseas, what has the experience been like in comparing the speed overseas to here in the United States? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to join in today's conversation with Rose Aguilar on Your Call. On the phone, 866-798-8255, toll-free, 866-798-TALK. You can also send your question or comment via email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the World Service of the BBC, World Have Your Say, and following that at noon today, it's Backstory here on KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the untold story of the Firestone Rubber Company in Liberia. We'll be joined by investigative reporter Jonathan Jones about the new Frontline documentary that's airing tomorrow night, Firestone and the Warlord. This investigation uncovers the secret relationship between the American company Firestone and Liberian warlord Charles Taylor. That's tomorrow. On Wednesday, we'll be joined by Shane Harris, author of the book At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. And then on Thursday, former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps will join us to talk about net neutrality and connecting everyone to the internet on Thursday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about why Americans pay so much for inferior internet service compared to the rest of the world. In the United States, we rank 31st in download speeds and pay up to 38 times as much as Japanese citizens pay to access the internet. So what questions or comments do you have about this? What is your speed like? What do you pay? And is your city trying to get more local access to the internet and to provide you with internet services? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by David K. Johnston. He teaches business, tax, and property law of the ancient world at Syracuse University College of Law, writes a column for Al Jazeera America, and is author of several books, including The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And he explores these issues, looking at, for example, how much people paid for phone service back in the early 90s compared to what they pay today. Christopher Mitchell is policy director at Next Century Cities, a recently launched consortium of 32 cities dedicated to ensuring the availability of broadband internet for all communities. And Christopher, if you could comment on Donald's point, and also I wanted to point out that Susan Crawford, who's a professor at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law, served as President Obama's Special Assistant for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy. She recently said that she's given up on the federal government when it comes to these issues. She believes that the power is really in the hands of cities and municipalities. What are your thoughts on that?
I think Susan's book, Captive Audience, is a must-read for people in this audience. It's right up there with The Fine Print by David, and I don't think she's actually given up on the federal level. I don't think we have that luxury, frankly. I think we need to look to the local level for leadership, but we need to guard our back by making sure that the cable companies don't get too greedy in taking and making the rules of Washington. But to speak to Donald's question, I think the issue of states overruling local laws, of states passing laws to overrule local power to build their own networks is very dangerous. It actually has not happened in California quite to the extent that Donald suggested. I don't want to disagree with him, but I want to make sure people are aware that there's broad authority within California to do this still. It's more difficult in rural areas because of one of the laws, and the legislature has certainly cracked down on local authority to get good deals from the cable companies in franchise negotiations. But there's still lots of authority for local governments to do this. And indeed, Santa Monica has a network that connects businesses and is starting to connect some residents. There's a number of networks throughout California, and the city of Palo Alto is considering one once again. It's looked at this off and on for the past 10 or 15 years.
We have an email from Lori who says, I currently use Sonic, a locally based ISP in Santa Rosa, and I'm very happy with their service, including immediate text service with a human being. With Sonic, my internet download and upload speeds are much faster than my prior provider, Earthlink. I don't have a TV and don't need super high internet, and I'm unwilling to pay for or subscribe to monopoly cable. With Sonic, I'm paying less for combined landline phone and internet than I did with AT&T and Earthlink. We also have a question. Why does it matter if our speeds are relatively slow? Even if we can't keep up with South Korea, aren't we getting more data per second than ever? David, do you want to take that first?
Well, that's a good question. And to a lot of people, it may seem not at all important to have high speed. The issue is that if you imagine America today if we hadn't invented jetliners, which grew out of military spending in World War II to create jet engines and pressurized cabins and much higher quality metals. that make it possible to fly. We would have a much different economy. If we build a internet with tremendous capacity in it, there are a number of economic studies that suggest it would significantly grow our gross national product and create thousands of jobs. You couldn't create an airplane in the 1800s if you wanted to because the materials didn't exist. Well, there are all sorts of businesses that haven't even been imagined yet that are not going to be created here unless we have high-speed, universal internet service, certainly very fast service between any business areas.
What would you add to that, Christopher? Why does it matter if speeds here are relatively slow?
Well, I think the way I would look at it is similarly with a metaphor, and that's there is a number of people today who still refer to the electricity bill as the light bill because electricity was first seen as a means of illumination long before refrigeration, toasters, and all the other things we do with it, let alone computers now. And I think if we had stuck with an electric system that only supported light, you know, it would certainly be an improvement over what we had had before. But the fact that we built the system so robustly and we extended it to all Americans really supercharged our economy. And it led to the development of all kinds of new devices. It allowed us to establish markets all over the country. And similarly, we're seeing the same sort of thing happen. You know, history is not over. The internet's actually quite young relative to where it'll be in 40 or 50 years. And I think that making sure that people have an abundant connection, which is to say a relatively fast upload speed and download speed, which today we often just refer to as a gigabit, but we really don't care what the actual number is. We're talking about a connection that's so fast that anything you want to do, you can do, and you're not just waiting for the network to complete a task.
All right, well, thank you for the email. We have another caller. Let's go to Mizzy in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I actually have two perspectives on this. One, I have an internet connection in San Francisco, which I recently changed from Comcast to Sonic.net. And while Sonic is slower, I like their politics. But I also have an internet connection up in Mendocino County, which is satellite. And that one is HughesNet, and it costs twice as much as Sonic.net for 15 gigabytes a month in downloads. And they're artificially creating a shortage of data as if they have this limited amount of it, which is not true. And they've snowed the American people into believing that there's somehow some kind of, you know, that there's a shortage of data and that they have to spread it out thinly. And I think that this is one of the problems, is that people aren't educated to know that, like, this is costing them nothing.
Mm. Well, thank you for that. And what about the cost, David? How are these companies able to charge so much? For example, the $160 a month for the triple play.
Well, one of the things that's happening here, Rose, is the number of people subscribing to cable television is declining because it's become so expensive. And that also creates a risk of a cultural and social divide that would not be healthy for the country. Mm-hmm. They're able to charge these prices because if you want or need this kind of access, you just don't have alternatives to go to. And if there's only two providers, and in most places you're limited to two, few places, three providers. That's an oligopoly, and they are all going to practice something called price leadership. That's where you try to raise your competitors' prices and encourage them to come along with you, or predatory pricing if you want to get rid of a competitor, where a large company just slashes the price in a specific small area to destroy a small competitor. These are problems of why the rules matter. Government's function is to set the rules. And in 1996, what we got basically was there will be no rules that protect the interests of consumers and business. Now, the very biggest businesses don't care because they just buy their way out of this and it's immaterial to their total revenues. But anybody who's an entrepreneur who needs high-speed internet access for their office, if you're a physician, where you could be taking advantage of things like remote access to look at imaging and medical tests, These are significant costs, and it's a deadweight loss to society to have this kind of inefficiency. It retards and damages the economy.
And Susan Crawford, author of Captive Audience, points out that because the big companies have divided up the markets, about 80% of Americans, their only choice for high-capacity internet connection is their local cable company, or their local cable monopoly, in her words. Does that sound about right to you, David, 80% of Americans?
Yes, I'm sure that that's the rough figure of it. I mean, there, you know, if you live in New York City, you've got basically three options. If you live in Keokuk, Iowa, I'd be surprised if you have more than one.
Chris, she also points out that the laws make it really hard for cities to make these decisions themselves. And we briefly touched on this earlier, that 20 states in the U.S. have passed laws under pressure from internet providers that make it impossible or difficult for cities to make these decisions themselves. Can you talk about how that happened and what that means?
Sure. It's not very difficult to explain what happens. I mean, we see it in California, where AT&T sponsors a big event, a big golfing event, and their lobbyists get to hang out for hours with all of the legislators. It's basically old-fashioned lobbying. The cable and telephone companies live in every state capital, and there's almost no representation from consumer groups. I mean, in California, you actually have more than most states. But in most states, they have almost unparalleled power to shape legislation. And they basically say, it's not fair for us, these massive cable and telephone companies, to compete with your small towns. They are far too powerful if they build their own networks, and so we have to outlaw it. And they use, you know, slightly different language than I'm using, because I think it's an absurd claim. And then next thing you know, ALEC is holding, the American Legislative Exchange Council is holding sessions on it. There's a model bill that's introduced, and sometimes we're able to stop it. And in the 2004-2005 period, it was very difficult to stop, and so that's when most of those laws were passed. And there's about 20 states where it's much more difficult to build a network. Although, I do want to say that, you know, we've had several callers mentioning Sonic. There's local companies that really do a terrific job. There's not enough of them, frankly, and I've never heard a negative word about Sonic. But right now, they're building in Brentwood because the city was smart enough to have a smart conduit policy. And so that means that basically when streets were torn up or new buildings were built or housing developments were created, they put these tubes in the ground that Sonic can now put fiber through and hook people up. This is something that every local government should be figuring out how to do. I mean, I think many local governments will have to do more than this, but at a minimum, local governments need to be investing for the future, whether they're going to provide services themselves or whether they're going to enable a company like Sonic to do it.
David, what would you add on lobbying? The National Cable and Telecom Association spent almost $20 million last year lobbying. Comcast spent $20 million. You've got AT&T, Verizon also spending in the millions last year. AT&T,
well,
$15 million.
Yeah, I want to make it clear. Christopher's right on the money. I agree with everything that he has said about this, particularly this barring of competition that's very strong in some states like North Carolina and Tennessee. It's amazing that the people who most promote the laws that block competition turn out to be, in a number of states, Republican legislators. They're not promoting business principles of competition and free markets. They're promoting protectionism. And ALEC is very much a protectionist organization for big companies influencing legislators. And I don't understand why in the Republican Party there hasn't been a serious discussion about this. And I'd certainly like to see one arise. The problem with lobbying is that you and I don't have the access that the big donors do. You know, lobbying is a constitutionally protected activity under the First Amendment. You have a right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. But the government can also decide whose petitions it's going to read and whose it's going to ignore. And lo and behold, the people who have campaign contributions to be arranged for or against you, jobs to hand out. And we've seen many prominent legislators go to jobs either with these companies or their trade organizations at tremendous pay. they are calling the shots. And we really, this is part of a much larger problem. It affects pharma, foreign trade. We really need to get at how corrupt and institutionally corrupt we've allowed Washington and our state capitals to become.
Well, so where does this leave non-telecom industries who want to lobby for change here? I mean, if they're saying these slow speeds are really causing us problems, what role can they play in this, David?
Well, we have seen in some places around the country businesses rising up and saying that we need help, often doing it quietly. In, for example, Chattanooga, which has the only, I believe, still the only 1 gigabyte internet, and Lafayette, Louisiana, which has managed to attract some Hollywood animation business because of its municipal internet. We have seen cases of where businesses that understand this have gone out and fought for and gotten better internet, but they've mostly done it by saying, what do we do to take care of us, not how do we fix the public policy issue? And this has become a competitive attractant. I mean, both Lafayette and Chattanooga and several other cities are out promoting, come to our city, we've got the, you know, the fastest internet in America sort of things, and it's been a successful strategy for them.
Rose, can I build on that?
Sure, please.
So I just wanted to note that, David was right. At one time, Chattanooga was the only city with a gigabit connection available anywhere, but there's a number more of them, and for a long time it was only municipalities and Google cities. And still, if you want to get a citywide connection where almost every community almost every household in a community has access, then odds are you're going to be looking at a community that has a municipal fiber network or one of the Google networks, because AT&T will only build fiber in select areas. But one of the things that we've seen is that when trying to get rid of these laws that limit local authority, businesses find that it's almost impossible to lobby together to overturn a law in Tennessee, for instance, because AT&T and Comcast, they own the subcommittees, they own the committees. You can't get something through there. So in Chattanooga and Wilson, North Carolina, which are two very successful gigabit networks, they have petitioned the FCC to remove state laws that limit local competition. Both states prevent Wilson and Chattanooga from serving their neighbors in need. And so this is something that's very popular with area businesses. And a group that's working around this issue is the Coalition for Local Internet Choice, which is something I'm also a part of, and people should do a little search on to get some more information, because it's incredibly important. At the federal level, Netflix is also pushing for municipal broadband, along with a number of other companies, saying that, you know, this should be a decision made at the local level. And to just wrap up with your final point on, you know, the fact that this is Republicans at the national level, it's staggering to me that Tea Party groups will listen to legislators that basically tell them, we believe that the state can overrule any authority that your community has. Because that's the exact opposite of what the Tea Party believes. The Tea Party really hates federal intervention, but they don't much like state intervention either. And I think the Republican Party will have a day of reckoning, because the leadership is out of sync with its grassroots on this point.
That is Christopher Mitchell. He's policy director at Next Century Cities, a recently launched consortium of 32 cities dedicated to ensuring the availability of broadband for all communities. David K. Johnston is he teaches business, tax, and property law of the ancient world at the Syracuse University College of Law. He is an investigative journalist, writes a column for Al Jazeera America, and explores these issues in the must-read book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And now I would like to welcome Zach Friend to the show. Zach is chair of the Santa Cruz County Board of Supervisors. Hi, Zach. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. So just last month, 32 cities launched Next Century Cities, a bipartisan city-to-city initiative dedicated to ensuring the availability of next-generation broadband for all communities. You've got Austin, Texas, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Jackson, Tennessee, Lafayette, Louisiana, and Santa Cruz. So can you tell us why you signed on, and tell us more about this initiative?
Well, absolutely. Well, in Santa Cruz County, we have, even though we rest in the shadow of Silicon Valley, we have woefully inadequate broadband infrastructure here, and about 30,000 people commute daily for tech jobs over the hill into the Santa Clara area, and a lot of them do it because we actually don't have the ability to provide for those businesses locally, even at a satellite-type situation. And so we decided, as the previous speakers were talking about the dominance of the major U.S. Internet service providers, that we needed to have some sense of a governmental intervention to make it easier for either A, a municipal build-out here, or B, to remove some of the barriers that they were claiming as to why they weren't doing broadband expansion here. So we created a set of policies that are becoming a statewide model, which allow for dig once, so when the roads are ripped up, you lay down the infrastructure. We also have master lease agreements to put things on county assets. And the most important thing was allowing for the installation and upgrades of broadband infrastructure in county rights of way. It was a pretty convoluted and complex process for the internet service providers to do it before we enacted these policies. What they claim is that we live in a rural area. And if anybody knows Santa Cruz, they know that it's not really that rural. It just doesn't have the same urban densities I guess they're used to. But rural equates, in their opinion, to it's not profitable enough for them to bother with it.
Hmm.
And so we had to make some set of policies that made it easier to help encourage them to go along the process. And it just seems to be, at its early stages, to be working.
Wow. I mean, it's so interesting because you're about 45 minutes from Silicon Valley. And so what is average internet speed like in Santa Cruz?
Most of my constituents, and I represent about 65,000 people, have the equivalent of a dial-up speed. I personally have a speed that on the highest that I can get would be about 4 megs. To get a gig, which was the previous speakers were talking about here, would be something that we would think would only come in a Christmas stocking. It just isn't the reality. And we've got a world-class university that is definitely fighting for more speed. And we also have local, very great internet service providers that are being pushed out of even using this backbone infrastructure by the high-profile nationals. And so anything that we could do to even allow the locals to compete, we thought would be advantageous.
So this just got off the ground, but it seems like such an ambitious project. How are you going to do this? I mean, how are you going to ensure that everyone in your community has, I guess, better, faster access to the internet, has faster speeds, I should say?
You know, a lot of it is changing the mentality of what's economic development and what's infrastructure. I mean, for a long time, it's how do you put in a car dealership or a big box store, or how do you build a new road? And if you look at this as equally important as the modern infrastructure of today, and if policymakers start thinking about it in the way that we're building a new road and amazing things can happen on that road, you can have bike lanes and sidewalks in some respects, and you can also have transportation methods in other ways. If we start looking at policy that way, I think over time you'll find that this will be is equally important, if not more important, economic development tool that's both environmentally friendly as well as just the new way that things are being done. And so it is ambitious, but it's also essential. I just don't see it as us having a choice. I have 30,000 people that are spending a couple hours a day away from their families to commute to jobs over in the Santa Clara Valley that they literally could be doing here if we provided them with the infrastructure.
That is Zach Friend. He's chair of the Santa Cruz County Board of Supervisors, and Santa Cruz is part of this 32 Cities initiative that was launched to lead on high-speed internet. We have a call from Santa Cruz, so let's hear from James. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I live in the mountains of Santa Cruz in Bonnie Dune, and I always have this dilemma of having to have a landline with AT&T, and I have the AT&T family plan for myself and my daughter, but there's no coverage where I live, and I've been calling for 3 years to AT&T and saying, what's going on? You say nationwide coverage. Don't I live in the nation or what? You know? So, I mean, the man previously was talking about words, how they trick us with words. And so I go, I don't need a landline. It's redundant. If you would put a tower in my area, and they put me to some engineer in Arizona who said, listen, buddy, I'm going to tell you the truth on this side. They're never going to build a tower where you live. So I'm just curious about how I can get service where I live. Mr. Friend might be a little bit more friendly.
Rose, if I can,
sure,
as a former, I grew up in Santa Cruz and I used to own a house in Bonnie Dune, and you're going to be at the very end of the line here for getting this kind of service unless government passes rules saying a condition of your providing the service is it has to be everywhere. Bonnie Dune's a wonderful place to live, but it is rural. It's the area north of Santa Cruz, up in the mountains. And it's just going to be at the end of the time. When I lived there, there was no cable TV. We got occasional signals from Channel 11 in San Jose and Channel 8 in Monterey, and that was, or Salinas, and that was it. And many people go, in fact, I know people who live there to this day because they feel like they're getting away from internet-connected America.
So, final thoughts, David. What can citizens do about this? In some cases, this didn't get hardly any attention on Election Day, but high-speed internet was on the ballot in some areas of the country. In Colorado, 7 communities passed resolutions saying they want to be allowed to provide internet service on their own. And then we're seeing this Next Century Cities initiative. What can citizens do about this?
Well, one of the very first things to do is tell your local and state officials that you want high-speed, low-cost internet. Send them clippings. Make sure your friends talk about this. Talk to business owners, and when they complain, and it's not hard to get business owners to complain, say to them, well, have you called, State Senator so-and-so, Assemblyman so-and-so, County Supervisor so-and-so, and encourage a discussion about this. I mean, that's the first simplest thing to do is to get people to complain, to petition.
All right. And Christopher, what would you add to that? About 30 seconds.
Well, that's the best advice you can give. Elected officials say they don't hear enough on it. I would say that this is something that local governments can solve. If you're in a rural area, you want to work together with others or partner with a cooperative. But there are approaches that will result in better internet access, and it may not be next year, but we can certainly get there in the next 5 to 10 years where everyone has a good level of access.
Christopher Mitchell is Policy Director at Next Century Cities. David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And Zach Friend is Chair of the Santa Cruz County Board of Supervisors. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What is the untold story of the Firestone Rubber Company in Liberia? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with investigative reporter Jonathan Jones about the Frontline documentary Firestone and the Warlord. The ProPublica Frontline investigation uncovers the secret relationship between Firestone and Liberian warlord Charles Taylor. So how interwoven is this relationship? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.